Goddesses, and welcome back to the Oh My Goddess podcast, the podcast where we celebrate inspiring women, both mythological and modern. I am your host, Stephanie, and this is our first normal episode in quite a while, and I'm going to update you guys on a few changes. So first things first, Taylor has made the decision to permanently step away from the podcast. We are of course still friends, but you know, life gets crazy, life gets busy, and her heart just hasn't been in it for a while, and she has other things that need to be her priority right now. So as of right now, it's just little old me. I have a couple friends who are considering joining me, but honestly, with me moving to Europe with my husband's job here in the very near future, the realisticness of collaborating with someone in the United States, like, permanently is just not, it's not really reasonable. So I will probably have some, like, guest hosts on a lot more often where, like, I'll be doing the research and sharing, but they'll be here for banter and commentary and to just bring a different perspective to the show. So that's the biggest change right now. I am going to be recording a bunch of episodes in the very near future because, like I said, I will be moving in a big way in the very near future, and there's so much to do, and it's terrifying, and I cannot keep just not recording, because, you know, big picture, this is obviously, like, a hobby of mine, and I enjoy doing this podcast, and I especially enjoy learning about, like, women in history, especially, like, ones you don't normally hear of. I really try and go for some, like, obscure people. And especially right now, that's extremely important. And I'll get into current events here in a second. But, you know, I want to really fully commit to this project of mine and grow this podcast in any way that I can. And that requires a certain level of commitment from me. So it's time for me to step my game up and fully put my heart back into this project, because the main goal of this podcast is and has always been to empower women and to educate people on women's issues. And that's something I would like to put more of my energy into. So that's my goal. So, going back to current events, obviously, unless you're living under a rock, America is going through it, specifically African Americans, and this isn't just a one-off incident that's led to protests in literally every single state in America, and I believe 12 different countries. This isn't a one-off thing. It is not a one-time thing. This is centuries in the making. And if I can use the tiny platform I have to bring attention to it, that is 100% what I plan to do. So fully anticipate the next, honestly, for the foreseeable future, this podcast will be focusing solely on women of color, especially women in the civil rights movement, either in history or current, or women of color who are in the LGBTQ plus community, because it is Pride Month, and I definitely want to incorporate that as well, because that's just as important. But right now, our Black community needs us. It needs white allies, and not just white allies. It needs white people who are willing to step up to the plate, be vocal, and educate the people around us. It is not the job of the African American community to explain to your racist aunt why she's being racist. That's on you. You need to have those conversations. And if I can use this podcast to either share information or examples or stories of things that have been happening throughout history and that are happening today, that is 100% what I plan to do, because this is a feminist podcast, and if we are not intersectional, it is not feminism. And I am not here for white feminism. We don't have time for that. That's not what we need in the world right now. So, that being said, today's episode, we are starting off with a bang, and this episode is dedicated to Asada Shakur. So Asada Shakur, who was born Joanne Deborah Byron in July of 1947, you may also hear her referred to by her married last name, which is Chesimard, is a former member of the Black Liberation Army, who was convicted as an accomplice of the first-degree murder of State Trooper Warner Forster during a shootout on the New Jersey Turnpike in 1973. Shakur was also the target of the FBI's COINTELPRO, which stands for a counterintelligence program directed against the Black Power movement groups and activists. So let's start off by talking about what Black Power was. So, Black Power is a political slogan and a name which is given to various ideologies which aim to achieve self-determination for people of African descent. So, it was a prominent movement in the late 1960s and early 70s, and it emphasized racial pride in the creation of Black political and cultural institutions to nurture and promote Black collective interests and advance Black values. So there's a range of political goals, from defense against racial oppression, establishment of social institutions, and a self-sufficient economy. And this includes Black-owned bookstores, cooperatives, farms, media. But the movement was criticized for alienating itself from the mainstream civil rights movement because it apparently supported racial segregation and kind of had this underlying message of Black superiority over other races. It was a controversial movement, especially back then, and I think the main idea of it was Black independence. I mean, if you think about places like, what is it? I think Tulsa, Oklahoma started off as a African American city. It was where they had their own stock market. Like, they were so successful. They were thriving. And white people came in and were like, oh, no, and ended it. And that's definitely not the only occurrence of a situation like that happening. I just learned today about how Central Park started off as a primarily Black neighborhood, and they were thriving. And they got completely disenfranchised by the New York government, told to move out, and they built Central Park on top of it. And with that being such a repeated occurrence of Black neighborhoods or areas or communities establishing themselves and becoming really successful, just to be kicked out and disenfranchised over and over and over again, you can completely understand why they would be like, you know what? Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. We'll live here and we'll be amazing. Because throughout history, over and over and over again, that proved successful until white people interfered. So while it feels, especially if you're a white person, like what? Almost like a, not a foreign concept, because hey, that's exactly what we did for centuries and even today, some of us, unfortunately, you have to understand history and history repeating itself fully supports this mentality. Like I said earlier, Asada Shakur was part of the Black Liberation Army. Now, trust me, all I went in like a Wikipedia spiral. There's so much background information you have to have in order to understand this individual. So, the Black Liberation Army was an underground Black Power organization that operated in the United States from 1970 to 1981. And this was composed entirely of Black Panthers who served as members of both groups. And the organization's program was one of war against the United States government, and its stated goal was to take up arms for the liberation and self-determination of Black people in the United States. And the BLA carried out a series of bombings, killings of police officers and drug dealers, robberies, and prison breaks. The Black Liberation Army gained strength as the Black Panther Party membership declined. And this is because by 1970, police and FBI sabotage, such as COINTELPRO, which y'all I'm gonna get into, infiltration, lengthy prison sentences, death of key members such as Fred Hampton, police just fully shot up his house completely after he was drugged with barbiturates. And next to him was his wife, who was 9 months pregnant with their child. And they just opened fire. So you can understand how things are being escalated and ideologies are going to get more and more extreme. This is what they're dealing with. There are full-on agencies in the FBI whose whole job it is to sabotage Black Panther movements, to sabotage Black Power movements, to sabotage Black people improving their station in America. Not to mention whose whole job it is to release propaganda that paints them as criminals and rapists and drug dealers and drug addicts. Of course, they are going to have a mentality of we are at war with the United States because they tell you what? They were. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the Black Panthers. I promise you I'm going to get to the story of Assata Shakur, but give me a minute. So the Black Panther Party, which originally was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, was a revolutionary socialist political organization founded by a college student, or a few college students, Bobby Seale and Huey Newton, in October of 1966. It started in Oakland, California. And the party was active in the United States from 66 until 1982, with chapters in a bunch of major cities and international chapters in the United Kingdom in the early 1970s and in Algeria from 69 to 72. The core practice was its open carry armed citizens patrols, so essentially cop watching, to monitor the behavior of officers of the Oakland Police Department and challenge police brutality in the city. This was an organized with a clear message and a clear voice and clear leadership. And these people were not only painted as crazy leftist armed black men, you should be terrified, and then they were taken out. But let me tell you a little bit more about them. So they had programs such as free breakfast for children to address food injustice and community health clinics for education and treatment of diseases, including sickle cell anemia, tuberculosis, and later HIV and AIDS, which is disproportionately affecting African American people. Well, sickle cell anemia, I believe, is only found in people of African descent. I could be wrong, though. But because it is, these things are so dominantly in the African community for a very, very, very long time, and honestly, probably even now, they weren't being aggressively researched or looking for cures in the medical field. With these being their goals, especially cop watching, monitoring police brutality, of course, police are going after them and they're going after them hard. And so, of course, you're going to end up with fatal firefights with police. Kind of like what we're seeing in protests now, where there's a lot of instigation by people who should be there to serve and protect. Their leaders are getting killed. There's an act passed by the California legislature, the Mulford Act, signed by Governor Ronald Reagan, establishing strict gun laws that stripped legal ownership of firearms from Black Panther members. Not to mention, J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director, described the party as the greatest threat to internal security, and he developed and supervised an extensive counterintelligence program of surveillance, infiltration, perjury, police harassment, and many other tactics designed to undermine Panther leadership, incriminate and assassinate party members, discredit and criminalize the party, and drain organizational resources and manpower. So let's talk about COINTELPRO. So COINTELPRO stands for Counterintelligence Program, and it was in place from 1956 to 1971. And it was a series of covert and illegal projects conducted by the United States FBI aimed at surveilling, infiltrating, discrediting, and disrupting American political organizations, specifically Black Power and the Black Panther movement. And while it has this broad idea, listen to who they're targeting and deemed subversive: feminist organizations, anti-Vietnam War organizations, the Civil Rights Movement, Black Power Movement, Martin Luther King Jr., Nation of Islam, Black Panther Party, environmentalists and animal rights organization, the American Indian Movement, Puerto Rican independence groups. Interesting. However, they did target the KKK in 1964, according to Wikipedia, which sounds like a very short time considering its 15-year program. Okay, so now that we have set the scene of what's going on, we maybe just have a scooch more of an understanding of the Black mindset at this point in time. Let's talk about our girl, Asada Shakur. So she was born in Queens and grew up in New York City and also in Wilmington, North Carolina. So after she ran away from home several times, her aunt, who would later become one of her lawyers, took her in, and she became involved in political activism at the Borough of Manhattan Community College and City College of New York. After graduation, she began using the name Asada Shakur and briefly joined the Black Panther Party, and then she joined the BLA, the Black Liberation Army, a loosely knit offshoot of the Black Panthers. So she was engaged in armed struggles against the US government through tactics such as robbing banks and killing police officers and drug dealers. Do I support the killing of people, period? Absolutely not. However, I do think it is important to talk about people like this now and to change the narrative because, frankly, there's a lot of manipulation from the government and the media to paint a lot of these people as way worse than they were. So between 1971 and 1973, she was charged with several crimes, subject to a multi-state manhunt, and in May of 1973, she was arrested after being wounded in a shootout on the New Jersey Turnpike. Between 1973 and 77, she was charged with murder, attempted murder, armed robbery, bank robbery, and kidnapping in relation to the shootout and six other incidents. So let's dive a little deeper into her early life and education. She grew up with her mother and her grandparents. In 1950, her parents divorced, so she moved with her grandparents to Wilmington from Queens, and Shakur moved back to Queens with her mother and stepfather after elementary school. Her family struggled financially. There's a lot of argument in the home. She spent little time at home, and she often ran away, staying with strangers and working for short periods of time until she was taken in by her mother's sister, her aunt, who was a civil rights worker who lived in Manhattan. She has said that her aunt was the heroine of her childhood as she was constantly introducing her to new things. She describes her aunt as being, quote, very sophisticated and knew all kinds of things. She was right up my alley because I was forever asking all kinds of questions and I wanted to know everything. She took her to museums, theaters, art galleries. Shakur ended up converting to Roman Catholicism as a child and attended an all-girls Catholic high school before transferring to public school. She ended up dropping out and she later earned her GED with her aunt's help. In high school, there are often few or no other Black students in her classes, and she later wrote that her teachers seemed surprised when she answered a question in class as if not expecting Black people to be intelligent or engaged, and that what she taught was a sugar-coated version of history that ignored the oppression and suffering by people of color, especially in the United States. She later wrote in her autobiography, quote, I didn't know what a fool they had made out of me until I grew up and started to read real history. And that continues to be an issue even now. I mean, I'm a college-educated person in America, and there's still so much I'm learning of what actually happened throughout history. And it's insane, because we just don't get taught it. She ended up attending community college and then the City College of New York in the mid-60s, and she was involved in a lot of political activities, protests, sit-ins, and she was arrested for the first time with 100 other students from her community college in 1967 on charges of trespassing. The students had chained and locked the entrance to a college building to protest low numbers of Black faculty in the absence of a Black studies program. She ended up getting married to Louis Chesimard, another student she went to City College of New York with, and their married life ended within a year. They divorced in December 1970. In her memoir, her whole marriage only gets one paragraph where she writes that it ended over differing views of gender roles. So after graduating from college, she moved to Oakland, California, and joined the Black Panther Party. She worked with the Black Panther Party to organize protests and community education programs. And then, after returning to New York City, she ended up leading the Black Panther Party chapter in Harlem, coordinating the free breakfast program for children, free clinics, and community outreach. She soon left the party because she disliked this like macho behavior of the men and believing that BPP lacked knowledge and understanding of United States Black history. Shakur then joined the VLA, which was an offshoot of the BPP, whose members were inspired by the Viet Cong and the Battle of Algiers, and they led a campaign of, quote, terrorist activities against the U.S. government using tactics such as planting bombs, holding up banks, and murdering drug dealers and police. She began using the name Asada Shakur in 1971 and rejected her given name Joanne Chesimard as a, quote, slave name. Asada is a West African name derived from the Arabic name Aisha, and it's said to mean she who struggles, while Shakur means thankful one in Arabic. Her middle name, which I know I'm going to butcher this, but I'm going to do my best, Alagbala, means savior in Yoruba. So she now identifies as an African and felt her old name no longer fit. She said, "It sounded so strange when people called me Joanne. It really had nothing to do with me. I didn't feel like no Joanne, or no Negro, or no American. I felt like an African woman." After she joined the BLA, things started to escalate. So in April 1971, she was shot in the stomach during a struggle with a guest at the Statler Hilton Hotel in Manhattan. According to police, Shakur knocked on the door of the guest room, asked, "Is there a party going on here?" and then displayed a revolver and demanded money. In 1987, Shakur confirmed to a journalist that there was a drug connection to this incident, but refused to elaborate. She was booked on charges of attempted robbery, felonious assault, reckless endangerment, and possession of deadly weapon, then released on bail. Shakur is alleged to have said that she was glad that she had been shot, since afterward she was no longer afraid to be shot again. Following an incident in August of 1971, which was a bank robbery in Queens, she was sought for questioning. Photograph of a woman who was alleged to be Shakur wearing thick-rimmed black glasses with a high hairdo pulled tightly over her head and pointing a gun was widely displayed in banks. The New York Clearinghouse Association paid for full-page ads displaying material about Shakur. In December 1971, she was named by the New York City Police Department as one of four suspects in a hand grenade attack that destroyed a police car and injured two officers in Massapequa, Queens. Shakur is one of those wanted for questioning, ruining a police officer, attempting to serve traffic summons in Brooklyn in January 1972. Based on FBI photographs, Monsignor John Powis alleged that Shakur was involved in an armed robbery at Our Lady of the Presentation Church in Brownsville, Brooklyn on September 14, 1972. In 1972, Shakur became the subject of a nationwide manhunt after the FBI alleged that she had led a BLA cell that had conducted a series of cold-blooded murders of New York City police officers. The FBI said these included the execution-style murders of New York City police officers Joseph Piangentini and Waverly Jones on May 21, 1971, and NYPD officers Gregory Foster and Rocco Lori on January 28, 1972. She was alleged to have been directly involved with the Foster and Lori murders and connected to the Piangentini and Jones murders. So in Cuba, Shakur was asked about the BLA's alleged involvement in these killings, and she responded that, quote, "In reality, armed struggle historically has been used by people to liberate themselves. But the question lies in, when do people use armed struggle? There are people in the BLA who absolutely took the position that it was time to resist, and if Black people didn't start to fight back against police brutality and didn't start to wage armed resistance, we would be annihilated." And to me, all I hear when I read that quote is fear. Is fear from, again, centuries of the same things happening over and over and over again and nothing changing. And when you're living in fear for your life for that long, of course, these things and these type of movements are going to happen, period. So some sources say Shakur is essentially the head of the BLA after the arrest of co-founder Daruba Moore. She was described as the final wanted fugitive, the soul of the gang, the mother hen who kept them together, kept them moving, kept them shooting. And years later, Some police officers argued that her importance in the BLA had been exaggerated by the police, with one saying that they themselves had created a myth to demonize Shakur because she was an educated, young, and attractive woman. And I'm glad to have read that because I mean, you guys know Wikipedia is like almost always my main source, and that's kind of what I'm going off of right now. And it feels very one-sided. While we're getting direct quotes from her, it still feels like she's being demonized, and it feels like we're not getting the full picture. So for police officers themselves to be like, this was exaggerated to silence a person we found threatening, is refreshing. So by June 1973, and what would become the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, is issuing nearly daily briefings on Shakur's status and the allegations against her. Daily briefings in the FBI. That's mind-blowing. So the FBI and local police initiated a national search and destroy mission for suspected BLA members. They collaborated in stakeouts that were the products of intensive political repression and counterintelligence campaigns like, quote, New Kill, which is something I haven't heard of, but I'm going to have to do some reading about. They attempted to tie Asada to every suspected action of the BLA involving a woman. And then later on, they also became the coordinating body in the search for Asada and the renewed campaign to smash the BLA after she escaped from prison. After her capture, however, she was not charged with any of the crimes for which she was the suspect of the manhunt. Shakur and others claim that she was targeted by the FBI's COINTELPRO as a result of her involvement with the Black Liberation organizations, and there's documentary evidence that suggests that Shakur was targeted by an investigation named CHESROB, C-H-E-S-R-O-B, which attempted to hook former New York Panther Asada Shakur to virtually every bank robbery or violent crime involving a Black woman on the East Coast. Although named after Shakur, CHESROB, like its predecessor Newkill, was not limited to Shakur. So, I'm guessing the Chess, C-H-E-S, comes from her married name, Chesimard. Interesting, I didn't make that connection. So then there's the whole situation with the New Jersey Turnpike shootout, which happened on May 2nd, 1973, around 12:45 a.m. Asada Shakur, with a couple other people, were stopped on the New Jersey Turnpike in East Brunswick for driving with a broken taillight by a state trooper. Why does it feel like so many incidences where a Black person is killed by police, it starts off as a routine traffic stop for a broken taillight? Why is that like a constant theme that I see? Like, is that code for something? It literally almost feels like that. Because when you're in your car, you can't see if your brake lights are working. You can't say, like, they're absolutely not broken, officer. Okay, bye. You have, like, it just feels so nefarious. It really, really does. Moving on. Also, they were slightly, quote, exceeding the speed limit. So one of her, I guess, colleagues, you could say, Sundiata Akoli, who was born Clark Squire, was the one driving, and the state trooper asked for their driver's license and noticed a discrepancy and then asked him to get out of the car and questioned him at the rear of the vehicle. And this is where accounts start to differ, and it's where the confrontation kind of really initiated. But in the end, Trooper Forster was shot twice in the head with his own gun and killed. Zaid Shakur was killed, and Asada and Trooper Harper were wounded. So at A. Coley's trial, Harper testified, so this is the other state trooper, testified that the gunfight started seconds, quote, seconds after Forster arrived at the scene. At this trial, Harper said that Forster reached into the vehicle, pulled out and held up a semi-automatic pistol and ammunition magazine and said, "Jim, look what I found," while facing Harper at the rear of the vehicle. At this point, Asada Shakur and Zaid Shakur were ordered to put their hands on their laps and not to move. Harper said that Asada Shakur then reached down to the right of her leg and pulled out a pistol and shot him in the shoulder, after which he retreated to behind his vehicle. He said he saw Forster shot just as Asada Shakur was felled by bullets from Harper's gun. Harper testified that Akoli shot Forster with a .38 caliber semi-automatic pistol and then used Forster's own gun to, quote, execute him. So after this happened, Akoli then drove the car which had Assata Shakur, who was wounded, and Zayd Shakur, who was either dead or dying, 5 miles down the road, chased by three patrol cars, and the booths down the turnpike were alerted. So Okoli then exited the car after being ordered to halt by a trooper, fled into the woods, and the trooper emptied his gun. Assata Shakur then walked towards the troopers with her bloodied arms raised in surrender. Okoli was captured after a 36-hour manhunt involving 400 people, state police helicopters, and bloodhounds. And Zayd Shakur's body was found in a nearby gully along the road. Which I don't understand how that happened if he was already dead or dying in the back seat. Like, if they. I'm not sure, like, what happened from being dead in the back seat and then found in a gully along the road. I don't know. So, according to New Jersey police, Assata Shakur was on her way to a hideout in Philadelphia and then heading ultimately for DC. And there's a book in the vehicle which contained a list of potential BLA targets. But Assata testified that she was on her way to Baltimore for a job as a bar waitress. So, since she was wounded, she was moved to Middlesex General Hospital under heavy guard and was reported to be in serious condition. Trooper Harper was wounded in the left shoulder but was in good condition and given a protective guard at the hospital. Shakur is interrogated and arraigned from her hospital bed, and her medical care during this period is often said to be substandard. She was transferred from that hospital to another one, and after her lawyers obtained a court order, she was transferred to Middlesex County Workhouse a few weeks later. During an interview, Shakur talked about her treatment from the police and medical staff at Middlesex General Hospital, and she stated that police were beating and choking her and doing everything they could possibly do as soon as the doctors and nurses would go outside. In early 1979, the quote, the family, which is a group of BLA members, began to plan Shakur's escape from prison, and they financed this by stealing $105,000 from Bamberger's store in New Jersey. She escaped the Clinton Correctional Facility for Women in New Jersey when three members of the BLA who were visiting her drew concealed 45 caliber pistols and a stack of dynamite. They seized two correction officers as hostages, commandeered a van, and escaped. No one was injured, including the officers held as hostages who were left in a parking lot. According to later testimony, she lived in Pittsburgh until 1980. And then she flew to the Bahamas. At the time of her escape, her lawyer had just started to prepare her appeal. But after her escape, Shakur lived as a fugitive for several years. The FBI circulated wanted posters throughout the New York and New Jersey area. Her supporters hung Assata Shakur's Welcome Here posters in response. In New York, 3 days after her escape, more than 5,000 demonstrators organized by the National Black Human Rights Coalition carried signs with the same slogan. At the rally, a statement from Shakur was circulated condemning U.S. prison conditions and calling for an independent new African state. And for years after her escape, the movements, activities, phone calls of all of her friends and relatives, including her daughter, walking to school, were monitored by investigators in an attempt to ascertain her whereabouts. In 1980, FBI director said that the search for her had been frustrated by residents' refusal to cooperate. And a New York Times editorial said that the department's commitment to, quote, enforce the law with vigor, but also with sensitivity for civil rights and civil liberties had been clouded by an apparently crude sweep through a Harlem building in search of Shakur. In particular, one day in April 1980, there was a raid on a building in Harlem, during which FBI agents armed with shotguns and machine guns broke down doors and searched through the building for several hours while preventing residents from leaving. Or this was seen by residents as having racist overtones. Since her escape, Shakur had been charged with unlawful flight to avoid imprisonment. So now she is in Cuba and has been since 1984. She was granted political asylum there. In 1985, her daughter, who had been raised by her mother in New York, by Shakur's mother in New York, came to live with her. And in 1987, her presence in Cuba became widely known, and she agreed to be interviewed. And that's Assata Shakur. We're starting off real heavy, real controversial, I know. But, you know, I've watched a lot of documentaries lately, things on YouTube, really whatever I can to educate myself more on the history of the struggle for civil rights for African American people, especially in this country. And so much of what's being said is people in that community who were strong and intelligent and successful leaders were criminalized and targeted and honestly killed by the American government because it scared them, because they knew they were right. Other people were learning from them that they were right and that something was going on and that something needed to change. And while I 100% do not agree with a lot of the methods of the BLA, obviously, but that's also being said by me, a white person of privilege who did not experience their life and did not experience the hardships that led them to those decisions and those actions. And I fully recognize that. Regardless of the controversy, I believe that Assata Shakur was an intelligent, strong leader in the Black community. And I think it's a shame that she was run out of the country in the way that she was, and that so many other people like her, regardless of how peaceful they were as leaders, were treated the exact same as she was. And there you go. This is installment one of a huge focus on Black women in history and modern day who were strong leaders. And I cannot wait to learn about more of them. And I can't wait to see more Black female leaders coming into the spotlight as we continue to progress, as we continue to fight the fight, as we continue to protest police brutality, as we continue to protest Black disenfranchisement, as we continue to protest blatant racism and inequalities that are happening in our country at the presidential level. And that's where I'm going to leave off today. Feels really weird to sell promo right now, but if you enjoy this podcast, if you like this podcast, please rate and subscribe. It helps us out a lot. Us, I keep saying us, it helps me out a lot. Us as an Oh My Goddess family. Share with your friends and family and follow me on social media, which is all linked below. I also have linked below a lot of different resources, petitions you can sign, places you can donate, and how you can contact your local representatives to discuss crimes that are happening to the Black community, such as police brutality and hate crimes, and that you expect them to do something about it because you have a voice and you need to use it. All right, I love you. Have a blessed week. Be your own goddess. Now roll the outro. Bum, bum, bum.
Thank you so much for listening to the Oh My Goddess podcast, produced, recorded, and edited by Taylor Reif and Stephanie Earle, with music by Bradley Parsons and artwork by Ari Milligan. If you would like to support us, you can do so by telling all of your friends about us and following us on social media. Also, by rating and reviewing us on iTunes or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Have a story about a goddess or wonderful woman in your own life? Shoot us an email to have your story shared on the podcast. Have a blessed day, y'all.